Ragamuffin Gospel is it leans into sort of a point, I think, that we want to kind of talk about this morning. First of all, the church is not perfect. Everybody just pause, take a deep breath, and allow that to sink in. We all know it, but we don't like to say it in public. The church is not perfect. We do fail. We have failed. The thing is, it's an organization. Like any human institution, eventually, at some point, will deviate from its mission. You know, banks, anybody remember 2008? Banks are human institutions. They fail. Educational systems and structures and everything that we build is in some way corrupted because we mess up. We don't do things perfectly. So the guys this weekend, guys retreat, one of the things we kind of talked about, I told them this was a spoiler because I had been thinking about this, but you know, some of you know this, if you're a farmer or ever have been, you plow and you're trying your best to keep the line straight, but you know, once in a while you might get off course a little bit. That's okay. Right? Because all you got to do is sort of acknowledge it and bring it back in line. The real problem that happens is when we refuse to admit that we've taken a little detour. We cannot admit it to ourselves or anybody else, and pretty soon we're in court demanding that the neighbor's field is ours because I plowed it. It's mine. I didn't go off course, right? That's what happens. Take one of the most common issues, I think, in the church's history, slavery. The Southern church, we've talked about this, especially in the South, but, you know, earlier maybe in the North, Jonathan Edwards was a New England preacher, one of my heroes in so many ways. Man of God, really, truly was, and he beat his slaves. I mean, how do you wrap your head around that? The church was a part of this institution and was responsible for it. And they propagated it. They supported it. They allowed their ministers to participate in it. They encouraged it. They preached. They found ways to interpret the Bible that would go right along with what they wanted to believe was okay, right? Either to say, well, okay, we'll just ignore it, or even sometimes to support it. They did it because they wanted their comfort, their safety. They didn't want to admit their failure. They didn't want to deal with things that they didn't want to deal with. Tim Keller sort of wraps this up really nicely. He says this, he says, if your God never disagrees with you, then you might be worshiping an idealized version of yourself. Think about that. I think sometimes we need to hear that. It was wrong for the church to support this institution. I think we'd all agree. I don't think there's anybody here today that would look back and say, well, what the church did was okay. We might kind of try to say, well, they had a different cultural moment. It was wrong. It was sin. But there's reasons for it. You know, not that it's justified, but it's understandable. We might try to do that. But I don't think any of us would look back and go, no, it was the right thing to do to have slavery and for the church to participate. I don't think we'd do that. This was cultural sin. Now, let me talk about sin for a minute. I don't use that word a whole lot, I don't think. I have been criticized sometimes for not using the word enough. It's not because I don't believe in sin. It's not because I don't think sin is powerful. It's not because I don't think sin will ultimately lead you to hell. The reason I don't use that word a lot is because most of us have no idea what it means. So what's the point in using a word that no one understands? It'd be like if I said, after church, I'm going to go impignorate my television. It's a real word. It means to pawn, to mortgage something, to pawn it off. But we don't know that word, so I say pawn. Some of you can come to the cleanup day and take stuff away and go impignorate it if you'd like to. So sin doesn't mean something that makes God angry. That's not what it means. It doesn't mean breaking a rule. It does make God angry, and it is breaking a rule, but that's not what it means. And it doesn't make God angry for the reason you think it does. Sin simply, literally means to miss the intended target. It means to miss the point. Now, this goes back to design. In the very beginning, God made man and woman and aimed them, if you will, at a target. This is what you're here for. This is your intention. Go hit it, right? To miss that is to sin. To miss the intended target. It's that simple. Now, it does make God angry, but not because it's breaking some kind of arbitrary rule that he set up, but because it breaks his creation. It messes up something that he built and declared to be very good. Now, I think every culture has its blind spots. Every time in history and every culture on earth in different places has things that they can't even see about themselves. Ingrained cultural sins, things that the church chooses to either accept or ignore, and pretty soon forgets that they're sins altogether. And then usually our grandkids or great-grandkids or great-great-great-grandkids come along and correct it. So before we say anything else, we should, as we look back, or even across the oceans, we should keep one thing in mind. We're not perfect. So let's hold that and let be very gracious as we can be toward judging others for their sin and think about what we may have that we are missing or not paying good attention to. And I think one of those is, in our culture, is our sexuality. I don't know that we grapple with that the way we should. I think there's certain things that we don't understand about the intended purpose and the areas that we struggle with sin. Now, I want to say one thing real quick. This is probably the most unpleasant sermon I've ever had to preach. We're talking about the gospel changes everything. I can't leave that out. But here's a struggle. While the Bible references sex and sexuality hundreds of times, there are stories of brokenness, terrible brokenness. There's lots of, here, don't do this, don't do that, right? We know that. But there's not a real solid, clear teaching, like a passage that we could read that says, here's the seven things you need to know in order to express this correctly. And so it's not that it's difficult, frankly, because it's this sermon is about sex. That's one reason it's difficult. But another reason it's difficult is because I can't open up seven verses and say, here's what we need to read. So instead, I'm going to have to give you a few verses and a broader picture, and it's based more on my understanding of front to back of the Bible and God's teaching than it is on seven verses. So you'll have to, in some ways, give me that. Next week, we're going to return to studying verses and passages. We're going to look at four sections from Jesus' life and Passion Week. This week, we're going to look at a few different places. The one thing I want to look at first is in Revelation chapter 2, just because I think we need to hear this. Jesus speaks to several different churches in the opening chapters of Revelation. This is the church in Thyatira, one of them. The words of the Son of God, who has eyes like a flame of fire and whose feet are like burnished bronze. He says, I know your works, your love and faith and service and patient endurance, and that your latter works exceed the first, meaning translation, you've been doing more lately than you did before. But I have this against you, that you tolerate that woman Jezebel, who calls herself a prophetess and is teaching and seducing my servants to practice sexual immorality. So I think, I don't know, there's some metaphor wrapped up in that. There's some actual history from the church that actually was there at the time that John wrote this down. There's a lot of stuff. But the church, I think the lesson from this is the church should not tolerate sexual immorality. And I think we need to wrestle with this, because I think we may be missing the mark a little bit on this. Now, that's okay. The first way I think that is because even when I brought up the topic we're going to talk about today, some of us cringed. I kind of want to, too. We don't like talking about it. This is not a topic we particularly enjoy. But here's the problem, I think, and this is the first place that we've begun to miss the mark. Sex is the first. And one of the greatest gifts that God has given us. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. It's special. And we don't want to talk about it. We've taken it, this gift, and completely hidden it away. It's designed to be the embodied joining of two people. It is a gift of a way for us to completely give ourselves away to another person. I had this great video. Some of you have seen this. I'm going to ask River to play this video. Some of you have seen this, just a couple of minutes, because I think it's just a beautiful picture, a poetic picture, if you will, of what this is supposed to be. My mic off. There we go. Saying yes to another is a joining of our body to theirs. It's a beautiful thing. It's the way God made it. And I think one of the places that we've missed the mark by ignoring it, not talking about it enough, but another place is that we've turned it, and I don't know, chicken and egg here, but we've turned it into about receiving as opposed to giving. That's a very fundamental thing that we've done. See, sex is given to us as a way of giving ourselves to another person. And life comes out of this often. And we've turned it in a way of making it just about us. One thing, and I mean, my hypocrisy is going to be on full display here, but, and again, I'm not trying to make rules. This is not, a lot of these are thoughts that are maybe not coming right out of here. This one is one of those, but it's a thought that's worth me sharing. And again, hypocrite on this issue. But I wonder, I do. I have begun to wonder in recent years if birth control was not a way of us ensuring that our sexuality remained closed. In a sense, we made sure that we could receive without ever having to give anything. Now, I'm not saying it's wrong or it's immoral. I'm not going to go that far. It's just a thought. It's something to think about. Have we made sure, do we make sure, and I have made sure, that my sexuality will not have to go out, that I will not have to give myself to another as a result? And is that the way we're made to be? I don't know. It's worth wrestling through that for some of us, I think. I do think, I've always believed that God gave us sex as for procreation and recreation. So I'm not saying it's not. I believe that with all my heart. But I wonder if we should so quickly separate those two things from one another. See, what we did, we turned marriage, which is about two people, as they said on there, in love and appointed out, right, to kids, to family, to community. We turned marriage into a private affair between two people who love each other. And we made a wedding ceremony a celebration of two private individuals in love. Now, what a wedding ceremony used to be was friends and family would gather around to hear the couple swear their love and loyalty to one another throughout the rest of their lives. And the reason that they did that, it was not so that they could enjoy a nice piece of cake after and talk about, oh, how beautiful is her dress. That was not the point. The point was so that when those feelings of ooey-gooey love ultimately faded, and they will, that when that happened, those friends and family were witnesses who would call them up and say, hey, we watched. I saw what you said. You swore loyalty. And that they would be involved. I mean, there are times that it's right and safe and sane to run. And there's other times where the human is like, you know what, I'm done with this. I got to go. And that's where friends and family say, hang on. We don't do that anymore. There's a funny story. It's been told in my family for years. Some of you have probably heard me tell this. My parents had not been married for very long, and they lived not far from her parents. And they got in some fight. I don't even know what it was about. I've never heard the story. It's interesting. I've heard the story dozens of times, if not hundreds, and I don't know what the fight was about. It never seemed important. But they got a fight, and my mom got mad, and she storms out. She slams the door. I'm going home, right? And so she's on her way to her parents' house. And I don't know how this happened either, but my father spoke to her father on the phone. I don't know whether he called. I don't know how that was initiated. But anyway, talking on the phone. Yeah, we got in a fight. She's on her way home to your house. And when she gets there, my grandfather is standing on the front porch going, get your butt back to your house. Because he knew where she belonged now. He wasn't going to rescue her from herself. So I think that is probably the way community is designed to build that and to encourage that. Because sex was never just about ourselves and about our happiness and our pleasure, but about a way we give ourselves away to another person. Another place that I think we missed the target on this is, as I was thinking about it, I was going to say, well, the church still believes that sex outside of marriage is sin, not what we're aimed at. But I think the other thing I needed to say that I think we missed the target on is, I have to say, I think we believe that. I'm not sure that we do believe that. I saw a statistic recently, 80% of people who identify themselves as evangelical Christians will say that sex outside of marriage is wrong, or I don't know whether they'd use the word sin, or it's not the way it's supposed to be. 80%. So if you take 100, 80 of them said that, you take those 80, you separate them and ask them, how many of you have 70? So while we say we believe something, I wonder if our lives demonstrate that we believe it. Now, how do we get there? A couple of things. I think one way that I see this play out is, well, we're going to be married, right? And I want to be very clear. I'm not a legalist on a wedding ceremony. You don't have to stand here, right, in order to be committed to one another. I do believe that. I think we need witnesses. I think that focuses on the community part. I've always, our elders, sometimes we talk about this. We're like, hey, we should just have weddings every week. You want to get married? Come on. I don't care about a piece of paper from the government. Their definition of marriage is not mine anyway. So that doesn't matter. But we need witnesses who will say, hey, you promised to be faithful here, before we take that step. And here's why, because we don't need an escape hatch. I think that's a common trend that we've seen circling in our culture is, you know, let's live together, let's be married on every level, but I just want to keep the back door open if you're okay with that. And that's not safe. That's not healthy for us as human beings. I've used this illustration before. I think it's like gluing two pieces of paper together. You glue them together, you let it dry, and then you pull it apart. And what happens? You leave pieces of paper on each other. Most of us here, I would guess, who made different choices and now are married and been married for a while, probably all of us in that situation would say, if you ask them, I wish I had waited for this one. Because there are wounds, there are scars that get created when we do that. Some people will say serial monogamy is okay. I'm committed to this person until I'm not committed to this person, and I'm not cheating. And that's okay, right? Well, the same thing is true, isn't it? One after another, and you just create more and more and more scars on each other because that's not the way we were made to live. That's not what it was given to us for. And it destroys our souls when we use it in ways that it wasn't made to be used. So we made sex about self-pleasure, about receiving pleasure, and we made the sexual union about two private individuals in love. We did that. And now our culture has said, well, why not two men? So we have homosexual marriage. Legitimate, legalized in our society. This is a cultural reality. Some of us don't want to talk about that. Some of us want to bury our hands and pretend it does, our heads and pretend it doesn't exist. Some of us, you know, just some of us don't want to talk about it because we have people we dearly love who are in those relationships, and how can we judge them? So how do we navigate that? How does the church handle being here in this? This is the world our kids are growing up in. Okay, if you personally don't think that that is the way that human beings were designed to live, and you have kids or grandkids, we can't ignore this. We've got to learn to talk about it. How do we talk about it? The first thing we must do, or we will lose this fight. The first thing we must do is be honest about our own issues. Statistically, right here, 25 to 30% of the people in this room looked at porn in the last 30 days. Statistically, taking churches in America, we've not handled sexuality very well ourselves. We need to be honest about that. That's the very first thing we do. We must do. We need to call one another out on it. We need to ask people what they are doing in regards to sexuality. We need to be honest with a culture that thinks that we stand above them morally. We don't. We need to be honest about that. And then second, we need to bring back what we've hidden, and that's the beauty of sex. Now, George Michael has said this better than the church when he said, sex is beautiful, sex is good, in the 90s. And it embarrassed all of us. Here's what this is something else the guys looked at this past weekend. This quote from this theologian who died he was writing in the 50s, 60s. He said, we no longer dare to believe in beauty, and we make of it a mere appearance in order the more easily to dispose of it. Our situation today shows that beauty demands for itself at least as much courage and decision as do truth and goodness. Truth, goodness, and beauty. And she will not allow herself to be separated and banned from her two sisters without taking them along with herself in an act of mysterious vengeance. We can be sure that whoever sneers at her name as if she were a mere ornament, whether he admits it or not, can no longer pray and soon will no longer be able to love. See, what the church did maybe more than a century ago, what I think our culture did, and maybe we were participating in that too, is we took the beauty of sex and we hid it under a rock. And then the goodness faded, and now all we have left, and only by a scrap, and right here in the church, is the truth of what it's for. Now, he was exactly right, because we abandoned the beauty of two people in the marital relationship. It became, and then maybe for the last 20 years, and I think this is going, there was nothing good about it. We never held up people that had been married for 70 years and said, look at their beautiful relationship. We just stood there and said, you won't have those. You got to do it right. Truth alone cannot stand. That's why I like that video. It was beautiful. It almost made me tear up to see the way God made it to work. We don't put that on display the way we should, I don't think. We need to be honest about our own mistakes, and we need to display our beautiful marriages. Put them on display for the world to see, and let's talk about the beauty of it, the way God made it to be. Truth, goodness, and beauty ultimately point to the one who is truth and goodness and beauty, and it's God. So, okay, this is where we missed the target. How do we understand it? In light of the gospel, how does the gospel shape this? How do we come to grapple with this issue in our culture? First, we've got to understand that we are not our own. That's key. That's the first priority, and that goes way back to the creation story. We were made, and we were aimed at a target by another. We can't kind of move the target, say, well, you know what, I don't like it there, so I'm going to move it. Because when we move it, if we want to aim and kind of hit it with accuracy, what do we have to do? We have to bend ourselves. We have to manipulate ourselves in ways we were not made to work in order to hit the sideways target. That's what's happened. Psalm 2 says this, why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. See, I realize that it sounds harsh to say we need to do what God tells us to. But it's really not when we understand that we're not our own. He aimed us. He made us. He said, this is what you are made for. Fly. And we say, no. We cast his bonds apart away from us. If we understood this book, really, we'd understand that we have no right to define ourselves. We have no call to move the target around. All we can do is go where he pointed us. Second, we need to understand that we have perverted his design. We've perverted his design. This is a good word for this issue, because perversion literally means to take something good and use it for something bad, right? If you take a tire iron and hit someone in the head with it, it's a perversion. That's not what it's made for. We have perverted God's good design. And because we perverted his design, we get death. Death to our marriages, death to the definition of marriage. We get pain for our children. We get suffering. We get LGBTQ agenda. We get transsexuals and maybe same-sex attracted teenagers sitting right here in this room asking themselves the question right now, because you're talking about this, Pastor, is there any place for me among these greedy, porn-addicted, lustful adulterers in this room? Do I have a place? Because this is the issue you're talking about. Yes. That's death. It's not supposed to be that way. And we've perverted it. And we've caused that to come about that way because we didn't echo God's very good pronouncement on human sexuality. But the story doesn't end there. And I love, and I'm gonna say it, I'm gonna tell it again because I love this story, and I think I've said it here before, but Matt Chandler has this excellent story that is worth hearing. When we've come to recognize we're not ours and we've broken what was given to us, then we can hear this. He tells this story of having gone to a sort of a Christian concert type of thing, some evangelistic thing with this girl that he knew, and she had a bit of a sketchy past, and this guy comes and he's giving a talk, and he gives the typical canned Christian talk on abstinence, purity, whatever you want to call it, right? And one of the things he does is he passes a rose around the room. And finally, as he's talking, you know, the rose passes around 300, 400 people, different people. And he finally gets it back, and it's all beat up, and it's all, flowers are hanging off. And he asks the question, who would want a rose like this? Now, his point was that what I said earlier with the paper, you know, and you get scars and wounds. And he holds this rose up, and he says, who would want this? And he said it was all he could do to stay in his seat because he wanted to scream out with everything in him, Jesus wants the rose. We've got to hear that. Whether you are here and you have a dozen partners right now, whether you are same-sex attracted or transgender or in a homosexual relationship, it doesn't matter. Jesus wants you. Doesn't matter what your story is, we must hear that first and foremost. Now, here's the thing. It doesn't mean it's all going to go away, right? Oh, good. Jesus will take care of my attraction issues. Jesus will wipe away all of my scars. I won't feel pain from those 17 past relationships anymore. It'll all be over. No, that's not the way it works. We'll carry that stuff with us. But this comes with two promises. One from him. The promise from him is strongest. It's the most we can be really dependent on. It's certain. And it's found in Romans 8. Neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor demons, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things come, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will ever separate you from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus your Lord. Nothing. I don't care who you are. I don't care what you did. I don't care what you did yesterday. I don't care what you'll do tomorrow. Nothing can separate us. So often, sometimes we present it like everything except. Nothing can separate you from the love of Christ Jesus our Lord. Nothing. We can rest in that. In spite of what we've done, in spite of what we thought in the last 5 minutes, in spite of what we'll do tomorrow, we can hope in that promise because that promise is certain. But there is another promise involved in this call of Jesus. When we, the broken rose, come and we say, take me, there's Jesus' promise. I'm never going to let go of it, right? It's okay. Nothing. Not you, not me, nothing. But there is another one. When we said, take me, right? That's the step. That's it. Which means I will seek, however falteringly, however brokenly, however mistakenly, however stumbling, I will seek to conform my life to your will. I won't do it right. I will mess up. But I will seek to stop rebelling in my heart against your rule on my life. Will seek to be a radical disciple of Jesus in a world that does not share his values. Radical disciple means just that. People will look at you and go, what? I've never heard of that before. And it is increasingly becoming that way in our culture. And the question for us is, will we be radical disciples, or will we go, well, I mean, it's not that big a deal? Because that's the direction most of the church is going. Now, stop worrying for 5 minutes about what the Supreme Court did, or what Congress did, or what the president did, or what your neighbors are doing and who they're living with. Stop it. And worry about ourselves. Where are our lives not conforming to the will of God? Where are we failing to be radical disciples? See, that's our call, to be radical disciples and to love others well that don't agree with us. We cannot expect people who are not Christian to live like it. We can't. We can expect Christians to love them, regardless of the choices or the things or the feelings or the emotions or anything. We love them. And we can also expect the church to follow Jesus. We can expect that Christians will actually look like the word itself literally means, little Christs. We can expect that. We can aim for that, even though we'll fail. We don't do that because we want to somehow keep God's rules. We don't do that somehow because we want to make him look good. We do it because we love the one who loved us first. And we want to respond to his love with our own. Let's pray. Jesus, you are the one that wants the rose. And there is a lot of hurt. I know there is in this room over this issue. A lot of it. More than anything else, I pray that in spite of our scars and our wounds and our hurts that we have, some self-inflicted and some inflicted upon us, that we will feel deeply that you want us. That is first. Help us to know that more than anything else. And help us to run to you in our hearts and in our heads, the one who loves us deeply in spite of everything else. And God, help us to figure out what it means to conform our lives to your will for us in our sexuality and in our checking accounts and in every other way that we don't want to touch. It's in your name. Amen.